and the team. It's goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. إِنَّ رَبَّكُمُ اللَّهُ الَّذِي خَلَقَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ فِي سِتَّةِ أَيَّامٍ خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات بأمره ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية ادعوا ربكم تضرعوا إنه لا يحب المعتدين. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in 6 periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly, and He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Iran's foreign minister says the United States lacked any initiative during the recent talks on the revival of the JCPOA in Doha. The International Federation of Journalists says it will join the lawsuit against Israel at the International Criminal Court over the killing of a veteran Palestinian journalist. And the U.S. state of Ohio witnesses protests after new footage emerged of police officers fatally shooting an unarmed black man multiple times. Hello and welcome. We are coming to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Iran's foreign minister says the recent indirect talks between Tehran and Washington and the Qatari capital for the revival of the 2015 deal had been positive. Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remark in a phone call with his French counterpart, Catherine Colonna. He said the path of diplomacy for reaching an agreement is now open, advising the U.S. to take the opportunity. Amir Abdollahian underlined that Tehran is serious about achieving a good and lasting agreement on the deal known as the JCPOA. He, however, criticized Washington for not offering any initiative during the Doha talks. The top Iranian diplomat said Iran has always been committed to its obligations under the deal and expects the other sides to do the same. The French foreign minister, for her part, said all sides must strive for a deal agreeable to all of them. Colonna added the window of diplomacy is still open. Iran is wrapping up the Week of American Human Rights. The annual occasion marks a series of tragic incidents that killed Iranian people and statesmen where the U.S. was directly or indirectly involved. Yusuf Jalali reports from Tehran.
Highlighting the United States' rights violations at the former U.S. Embassy in Tehran, which the Islamic Republic calls the Den of Espionage. Every year in late June and early July, Iranian activists get together to commemorate what they call the American Human Rights Week, to recount instances of U.S. rights abuses in Iran.
United States, who is, you know, shouting the human right. We think that this is just, you know, slogan without any background. And because when it's go to the Iranian people, we think we have seen that these people have been targeted, and we do not receive any apology about that.
The week-long occasion marks a series of tragic incidents, all falling within the same time frame, killing hundreds of Iranians in the early years after the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Rights activists say in all of those instances, the footprints of the U.S. can be traced. One of the most tragic incidents was the 1988 shooting down of an Iranian airliner by the U.S. Navy, which killed all of the 290 people on board the doomed plane. More than three decades on, and Iran is still waiting for an apology from Washington. Rights activists believe the U.S. has not abandoned its double standards regarding human rights.
We know that more than 30 countries have received the negative sanctions from the United States. Sanction is something that violates the human rights, the right of the development, right of the education, right of the health.
The American Human Rights Week also marks the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of Iran's Islamic Republic Party, carried out by the formidable Mujahideen-e-Khalq terrorist organization, known as the MKO. 73 leading officials, including the then Justice Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, were killed in the blast. The Islamic Republic says the MKO is responsible for killing 12,000 Iranians in different terror attacks. In 2012, the U.S. and Europe delisted the MKO as a terrorist entity, and since then, they have been taking part in the terror group's annual summits in Paris.
They have withdrawn the MKO from the blacklist, and this withdrawal paved the way for the Americans, not only for the Americans, but also for the MKO to extend their own terrorist operations through the facilities that they are provided from the Americans and also from the European territories.
The 1987 chemical bombardment of Iran's city of Sardasht is another incident that falls on the same period in the Iranian calendar. Iraq's chemical weapons were reportedly produced using materials supplied by the U.S. and other Western countries.
Activists here say Washington has shrugged off its crimes in Iran, and that's why they observe the American Human Rights Week every year to take a jab at the U.S. for its selective approach toward human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The International Federation of Journalists says it will be a partner in a lawsuit filed against the Israeli regime at the International Criminal Court. The case was brought following the murder in May of veteran Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Aghla by the regime's troops in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. The journalists' syndicate says it has succeeded in exposing Israel's acts of aggression against media professionals and the Palestinian people. The Attorney General of the Palestinian Authority has confirmed that an Israeli soldier was behind the killing of Abu Aghla. Last month, Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki handed the ICC prosecutor the official outcome of the Palestinian investigation into the journalist's killing. The top diplomat has demanded criminals responsible for targeting civilians, children, women, journalists, doctors, and other protected groups be brought to justice at the international court. A young Palestinian man has succumbed to the wounds he suffered during clashes with Israeli forces. 19-year-old Kamal Abdullah Alavna came from the northern occupied West Bank city of Jenin. He was shot in the abdomen and right hand after Israeli forces raided the Flashpoint city on Saturday. Kamal was named after his brother, who was also killed by Israeli forces in 2003. At least 77 Palestinians, including 15 children, have been killed by the regime forces this year, 28 of them in Jenin. Israeli forces regularly carry out raids to allegedly make arrests in populated Palestinian communities. The raids have grown more violent and frequent since a number of deadly anti-Israeli operations in recent months. A Ramallah correspondent, Munar Andil, says the young Palestinian killed by Israeli troops in Jenin was shot both in the stomach and in the arm. Take a listen.
Well, Israeli forces raided the village of Jabaa in Jenin yesterday, and there were clashes between Israeli forces and Palestinian youths, according to our sources there. Kamal Alawni, 19-year-old Palestinian, was shot in the stomach and his arm, and he was transferred to Ibn Sina Hospital. Today, he succumbed to his injuries. And as you have mentioned, Kamal was named, after his brother. كامل العلاوني, his brother, was shot dead by the Israeli forces in 2003. Then his mother, of course, named the other child also Kamel Alawi. Today, it's a tragic, of course, incident for this Palestinian family and the mother to lose two of her sons having the same name. As you have mentioned, over 77 Palestinians have been killed by the Israeli troops since the beginning of this year. Almost 50 Palestinians were shot dead by the Israeli soldiers since March up till the day, including children.
Protesters marched in Akron in the U.S. state of Ohio after police footage showed officers fatally shot an unarmed black man multiple times. The protesters marched on the city's municipality to demand justice for the victim, Jalen Walker. Officers fired around 60 bullets at the 25-year-old after chasing him for a minor traffic violation last week. The newly released police footage shows Walker running away when he has gunned down. Walker's killing is the latest in a string of fatal shootings and racial profiling of African Americans by the police. The protests turned into a major social unrest in 2020 after the killing of George Floyd sparked protests against racial injustice both inside and outside the U.S. Intense fighting is raging in eastern Ukraine, with Russia saying its forces are now in full control of Lysychansk. The city is Ukraine's last remaining stronghold in the Luhansk region. A short while earlier, the Russian Defense Ministry reported that its forces were fighting Ukrainian troops inside the city after capturing the surrounding villages. With Lysychansk in their hands, Russian troops will be able to move further into the Donbass region. Just last week, they captured Severodonetsk, another major city in the east. Meantime, in Russia's border city of Belgorod, three people have been killed and several others wounded in several blasts. So far, no reactions from Kiev. The UK might join Canada in handing over Russian assets to Ukraine. London now mulls a plan to seize the assets of Russia to give them to either Ukrainian victims of the war or the Ukrainian state. British media reports say Foreign Secretary Liz Truss is supportive of the idea that frozen Russian assets be redistributed to the victims of Russia's war in Ukraine. Late last month, Canada decided to seize the assets of sanctioned Russian individuals and companies and use them to compensate victims of the Ukraine war. That is, in addition to several rounds of sanctions placed on Russia by Canada and other Western governments. NATO countries and Russia have been fighting an information war over events in Ukraine. While major Western media outlets are focused on the loss of life and damage from Russia's military campaign, there are Western journalists who are offering an alternative view of the events. Johnny Miller reports on a German journalist facing jail for reporting Ukrainian atrocities in the country's east. Here's more.
Alina Lipp, a German journalist who has been reporting from the pro-Russian Donbass region of Ukraine for over 6 months. She recently received charges from the German legal system threatening her with 3 years in jail.
On 24th of February, I shared on my Telegram channel the news that Ukraine is killing civilians already for 8 years. And I also said that this is a genocide and that people here in Donbass support the special operation of Russia. And this is a criminal act for Germany.
But Ukraine has been killing civilians here for 8 years. That's just, I think, controversial.
That's a fact. I'm filming here for half a year now, and I'm living in Donetsk, and I'm hearing all the day this shelling around me, and this is not Russia.
And another one it says there is that you said that most people here support the separatists. That's a fact as well.
That's a fact, yeah, of course.
A few days after Alina's charge sheet was issued, the main German TV channel ARD ran a story reporting that the Russian army was bombing Donetsk, but they weren't. It was the Ukrainian army. The next day, the channel published a retraction and apology. It's not clear how many people who saw the report also saw the retraction.
The courts have also taken 1,600 euros out of Alina's bank account, money given to her by members of the public who are appreciative of her work. They also say that she is not allowed to defend herself at a hearing. Now, I've read the document, and the only conclusion I can draw from it is that either the German courts are trying to prosecute honest journalists, or that, frankly, they don't have even the most basic grasp of international politics. I'm not sure which one is more damaging to the credibility of the German legal system.
They just want to put me in prison for 3 years, but not hear me out. I mean, what... It's unbelievable. And especially they open this case because I'm sharing my opinion. So there's no free speech anymore in Germany.
Luis Cervera, an independent Spanish-Russian journalist who has been reporting on the suffering of the Donbass people at the hands of the Ukrainian army.
At first, I received a lot of hate comments, hate in general. Then I received also harassment and then, from different people pursued me. They published my phone number, all my private information. They even published an address of a flat where I used to live.
While Julian Assange faces the prospect of spending the rest of his life in jail, he is not the only journalist under threat of imprisonment for telling the truth. Alina, like many other independent journalists, have been deplatformed from some social media outlets and has had her PayPal account suspended. Anti-war sites Consortium News and Mint Press have also had their PayPal accounts suspended in an attempt to cut off funding.
The job of a journalist is to uncover stories so that society can debate and implement policy based on their findings. Now, while mainstream outlets don't even send reporters to this part of Ukraine, the few Western reporters who are here risk their lives and their reputations to uncover important truths. For that, they risk being deplatformed, smeared, or sent to jail simply for doing their job. There's increasingly a worrying campaign by tech companies, governments, and courts to strangle anti-war dissent in the West. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
In Berlin, hundreds of people march into the streets to discourage the German government from intervention in the Ukraine war. The demonstrators carried banners denouncing armed supplies to Ukraine as well as nuclear weapons. Germany has offered substantial support to Ukraine, sending billions of dollars in military aid and heavy weaponry. That's in line with a policy adopted by certain Western governments to support Ukraine. Those governments include France, Britain, Canada, and Spain. The United States has so far allocated nearly $7 billion to military assistance for Ukraine. Russia, as always, warned such arms deliveries would only fuel the flames of war. Moscow has cut gas exports to Italy by 15%. The Italian government has played down the consequences of Russia's decision, but there are serious concerns among people about surging energy prices. In Australia, thousands of Sydney's residents will have to leave their homes as flooding hits southeastern parts of the city. More than 200 millimeters of rain have been recorded in many areas. As a result, local dams and rivers are starting to spill. The Weather Bureau is warning of a serious risk of flash floods and landslides. Officials are asking people to avoid unnecessary travels. The government says the emergency services and military troops are on standby to help people. The rainfall will continue for at least the next 2 days. Well, that's a wrap for this edition of World News. Thanks for your company. Stay with us.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terence fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need, which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willest, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
In the limelight. On Thursday, 30th of June, the U.S. Supreme Court's conservative majority, with its 6-3 ruling in the case of West Virginia versus the Environmental Protection Agency, curtailed the power of the agency to protect the environment, and specifically to require the reductions in emissions that are urgently necessary to limit global warming. The article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times. The piece has been published in the opinion section of the newspaper and is titled, The Supreme Court sabotages efforts to protect public health and safety. On Thursday, 30th of June, the U.S. Supreme Court's conservative majority, with its 6-3 ruling in the case of West Virginia versus the Environmental Protection Agency, curtailed the power of the agency to protect the environment, and specifically to require the reductions in carbon emissions that are urgently necessary to limit global warming. The court's ruling constrains any effort to lighten restrictions on carbon dioxide emissions from power plants. It also threatens the Biden administration's ability to impose new limits on tailpipe emissions from cars and trucks and on methane emissions from oil and gas facilities. As the three members of the court's liberal minority wrote in a stinging dissent, the majority's decision strips the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, of the power to respond to the most pressing environmental challenges of our times. The Biden administration, already struggling to persuade Congress to invest in renewable energy and compelled by the Russia-Ukraine conflict to push for increased production of fossil fuels, once again finds its ambitious goals of confronting climate change slipping beyond reach. The court's adversarial posture means the Biden administration must double down on its efforts to win congressional support for its spending plans. President Joe Biden and Democratic leaders should also press to pass legislation clarifying the Environmental Protection Agency's authority to regulate emissions. Thursday, 30th of June's ruling also has consequences far beyond environmental regulations. It threatens the ability of federal agencies to issue rules of any kind, including the regulations that ensure the safety of food, the safety of medicines and other consumer products, that protect workers from injuries and that prevent financial panics. In 1984, an earlier generation of conservative Supreme Court justices formalized a doctrine of deference to the judgment of regulatory agencies, modestly concluding that judges were neither experts nor elected officials, and therefore ought to leave such decisions in other hands. In Thursday's decision, the Supreme Court asserted that the policy of deference applies only to supposedly unimportant regulations. When it comes to major questions of regulatory policy, the court said it would not hesitate to second-guess regulators and to strike rules that it decides did not have a clear congressional warrant. The decision amounts to a warning shot across the bow of the administrative state. The court's current conservative majority, engaged in a counter-revolution against the norms of American society, is seeking to curtail the efforts of federal regulators to protect the public's health and safety. The court already invoked a similar logic during the COVID pandemic to strike down workplace COVID testing requirements and a federal moratorium on evictions. And by refraining from defining a threshold for what constitutes a major question, the court is leaving a sword hanging over every new rule. The West Virginia case has its origins in 2015, when the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, imposed new limits on carbon dioxide emissions from coal-fired power plants. The EPA determined that it was impossible for those plants to reduce emissions to what it regarded as a safe level while producing the same amount of electricity. Burning coal is simply too dirty. Accordingly, it directed companies to cut carbon emissions by reducing output or by shifting to other forms of power generation. The rule never took effect. The court stayed its implementation in 2016, and the Trump administration withdrew it in 2019. But the litigants, including the states of West Virginia and North Dakota, and a pair of coal companies, pressed ahead with a lawsuit to make sure the rules stayed dead. Chief Justice John Roberts, writing for the majority, agreed with their claim that the Environmental Protection Agency did not have the authority to require companies to shift resources to other kinds of power generation. Chief Justice John Roberts wrote that the court's long-standing policy in such cases of deference to the agency's own assessment of its authority did not apply because the stakes were too high. It is a theory long championed by Chief Justice Neil Gorsuch, who explained in a concurring opinion that administrative agencies must be able to point to clear congressional authorization when they claim the power to make decisions of vast economic and political significance. Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, clearly has the legal authority to set an acceptable standard for carbon emissions, in this case of carbon dioxide, and then to impose restrictions on emitters, in this case coal-fired power plants. The court did not contest these facts. Instead, it ruled that the Clean Air Act does not provide the Environmental Protection Agency with sufficient authority to achieve those emissions standards. Chief Justice John Roberts described this conclusion as a defense of congressional authority, an assertion of the primacy of elected officials. But constraining the power of regulatory agencies should not be understood as a shift in the locus of decision-making. Rather, it effectively prevents good decisions from being made. Congress has decided, and with good reason, that regulatory agencies staffed by experts are the best available mechanism for a representative democracy to make decisions in areas of technical complexity. The Environmental Protection Agency is the entity that Congress relies upon to figure out how clean the air should be and how to get there. Asserting that it lacks the power to perform its basic responsibilities is simply sabotage. It is a telling fact that power producers, electricity producers in response to market forces, have achieved a shift to cleaner energy that the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, sought to require in 2015, validating the agency's assessment of what it could reasonably mandate. Chief Justice John Roberts' predecessors recognized their own limitations. In the 1984 ruling that formalized the court's policy of regulatory deference, Chief Justice John Paul Stevens wrote that the judges are not experts in the field and are not part of either political branch of the government. Both points are important. The court lacks technical expertise and an electoral mandate. Last Thursday's decision asserting a more muscular role is thus a blow to both the public interest and to democracy.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how India has elevated its global stature by pursuing a proactive foreign policy vis-à-vis Russia, refusing to buckle under Western pressure. And we shall also take a look at Narendra Modi-led BJP government's failed experiment in Indian-controlled Kashmir amid the deteriorating security in the region.
In a show of extraordinary defiance to US pressures, India has not only continued but scaled up its oil purchases from Russia since the Ukraine war began 4 months ago. Russian oil now accounts for 10% of India's total crude imports compared to just 0.2% before the war. With Western countries announcing the boycott of Russia's energy market, Indian refiners have taken advantage of the situation, purchasing Russian oil at a discount of $30 per barrel.
India, the third largest oil consumer in the world after China and the US, has relied heavily on Arab countries for 85% of its oil needs. Before Russia launched its military operation in Ukraine in February, Iraq and Saudi Arabia were the two biggest suppliers of oil to New Delhi. In June, Moscow edged past Riyadh to become the second biggest supplier of oil to India, wooing Indian refiners with heavily discounted crude. According to industry data, of all crude oil imports from overseas, the share of Russia has surged more than 50 times in the last 3 months.
If you look at other countries, let us say in Europe, France, Britain, Japan, they're all dependent on the US for their security. Okay? India is not dependent on the US for its security. India is certainly likes US political support. But at the end of the day, India depends on itself. So it is self-interest which is driving Indian policy. I don't think any ideology drives it.
India and some other Asian countries have become key sources of oil revenue for Russia at a time when Washington and its NATO allies are attempting to cut Russia's energy market from the world over the Ukraine war. After failing to persuade the Narendra Modi government in New Delhi to cut its energy and defense ties with Russia, US officials have now come to recognize India's need for affordable energy. India's foreign ministry, as well as the Ministry of Petroleum, have repeatedly emphasized the country's need to protect its best interests, disregarding criticism over its imports of Russian oil.
India's firm stance on its time-tested relations with Russia and refusal to condemn Moscow's military operation in Ukraine or to snap its energy and defense ties with Russia is seen as a carefully choreographed move by New Delhi to project itself as a global player. In recent months, Western powers, including the US, vigorously courted India to deny strategic advantage to their chief adversary. The BJP-led government in New Delhi refused to join the circus, elevating India's stature at the global level and securing its burgeoning energy needs.
Many top Western officials made whirlwind trips to New Delhi in recent months in order to persuade the Indian government to recalibrate its position on Russia's military operation in Ukraine and to cut its dependence on Russian energy. Prime Minister Narendra Modi, however, stood his ground. His refusal to toe the Western line is seen by many as a calculated move to carve a superpower role for the world's second most populated country, pave the way for a multipolar international system, and lobby for India's permanent UN Security Council seat. India hasn't cut its ties with the US, though. The two countries continue to be strategic allies and are part of the Quad group along with Australia and Japan. But New Delhi has chosen to pursue an ultra-realist policy to safeguard its interests, including the overwhelming need for Russia's military equipment and oil. At first,
The strategy appeared to antagonize the U.S. when Joe Biden described India's position on Russia as somewhat shaky. But by April, Americans dramatically changed their tune and reluctantly accepted Modi's position. In the last few months, India has proactively pursued its ties with Russia by abstaining from UN resolutions against Russia and ramping up discounted crude imports as well as the purchase of military hardware.
Now, to have more insight on this issue, we are joined by Mr. Mubin Jafar Mir, Research Officer, Center for International Strategic Studies from Islamabad. Now, welcome to the program, Mr. Jafar Mir. India's imports of crude oil from Russia have significantly surged since the beginning of the Ukraine war. Now, could you say that this implies assertive foreign policy based on national interests?
Yes, I think it implies assertive foreign policy on part of India, as it is brushing aside the Western intimidation against anyone not opposing Russia over its invasion of Ukraine. I think economic interests are a precursor to formulating any foreign policy decision, and it applies on every state. And given the poor economic condition globally and rising inflation worldwide, every state prefers to follow economic interest, even if it comes on the altar of sacrificing its principles. And India, when we particularly talk about India, it has expansionist and hegemonic designs, and it can do anything to achieve that goal. And India has been successfully able to balance a role between Washington and Moscow because of the US policy of bolstering India as a counterweight to China. As you have asked whether its policy is assertive, I say yes, it's assertive, because if you recall Indian External Affairs Minister Dr. J.S. Shankar's statement earlier this month at Global Sec 2022 Forum, and that his statement was a clear manifestation of India's assertive foreign policy. He said that Europe's problems are the that he actually condemned Europe for criticizing India and said that Europe's problems are the world problems, but the world problems are not Europe's problems, and Europe has to get out of this mindset.
Mr. Jafar Mir, initially the Biden administration used many different tactics to persuade India to cut its energy and defense ties with Russia. So have the Americans now given up?
It's a very important question. Yes, it is true that India has not been listening to the West. But, you know, India is not an exception. There are many countries now in the world that are not accepting the Western rhetoric of isolating Russia. Many West Asian, Arab countries, and even European countries have not liked the idea of completely abandoning Russia and have not only continued but even further strengthened their ties with Russia. And whether you have asked if America has given up, it is difficult to say whether they have given up, but the U.S. lacks options in the foreseeable future. For now, the U.S. strategy, I think, would be to prolong the Ukraine war through pumping more financial and military aid to Ukrainian leadership, Ukrainian military, while simultaneously convincing India that a weak Russia can't help it in its aspiration to become a global power. The U.S. also cannot sever ties with India over Russia because India is a close ally of Israel. I mean, Israel is one of the top destinations of India to import its weapons. So that India-Israel nexus is also paramount to understand the U.S. policies towards India.
Mr. Jafar Mir, apart from discounted crude oil and military hardware, what makes Russia such an important partner for India, and has it got anything to do with India's strained ties with China?
Yes, it's a very good question. Russia is a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council and has been supporting India at various international forums. It has previously stood by India on its Kashmir stance, even at the time when the U.S. wanted to pursue the Kashmir case as per the UN resolutions. Unfortunately, that is no more the case, and the United States has in recent times strengthened its nuclear civil deal in India with severe consequences for strategic balance in the region. It has adversely impacted strategic stability in South Asia. And yes, it has a lot to do with Indo-China rivalry as well. India is fearful of Russia becoming overly dependent on China. India, in fact, is not very welcoming toward the idea of Western sanctions on Moscow. And if we see that Russia and if we talk about the importance of their bilateral ties, Russia looks at India as a hedge against complete Chinese domination in key parts of Eurasia, like Central Asia. Moscow desires that India becomes an economic force to be reckoned with in Central Asia and counters expanding Chinese economic influence there.
Mr. Jafarmir, thank you for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Dmitry Alexander Symes, a journalist focusing on Russia and Asia, notes that India's crude oil imports from Russia have jumped over 50 times since April, while before the Ukraine war, it made up for just 0.2% of India's total oil imports. Senior Indian broadcast journalist Pallavi Ghosh cites a senior government official telling her that India won't buckle under the G7 pressure on Russian oil imports or the Ukraine issue. Surya Kanagankar, a trader and analyst explaining India's decision to continue Russian oil imports, says every country that has leverage tries to use it, adding that the US tried to make 1.4 billion Indians suffer from inflation.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
After the Narendra Modi-led Hindu nationalist government in New Delhi stripped Kashmir of its semi-autonomous status and statehood in a controversial move that was advertised as a panacea for all the problems facing the disputed territory, things have not only not changed but turned worse. During this period, the security situation has deteriorated alarmingly with frequent gun battles and killings of civilians, militancy has surged, anti-India sentiments have deepened, the local economy has been destroyed, and the people have lost their means of livelihood.
On August the 5th, 2019, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party unilaterally scrapped a law that gave special status to Indian-controlled Kashmir amid stringent lockdown and massive military deployment in the contested Himalayan region. The government claimed that the move was aimed at ushering in peace and economic prosperity there. Almost 3 years down the line, peace and stability remain far-fetched dreams, while daily killings of both civilians and armed rebels continue. The facade of normalcy has been shattered. According to Kashmir police, this year alone, more than 100 suspected Kashmiri rebels, most of them youngsters aged between 18 and 26, have been killed by the Indian police and military forces. Since the abrogation of the region's semi-autonomous status 3 years ago, at least 197 security personnel, 675 suspected rebels, and 131 civilians have been killed as per official figures. Among those targeted are members of minority Hindu and Sikh communities and non-migrant workers who have lashed out at the ruling party in New Delhi for pushing the false narrative of normalcy and failing to provide them protection. The worsening security situation has prompted even pro-India figures to question PM Modi's muscular approach in Kashmir.
Revoking Kashmir's special status figured prominently on BJP's election agenda in 2019, which helped Narendra Modi return to power with a massive mandate. The move was designed to appease the majority Hindu community in India at the risk of fueling anti-India sentiments in the contested region. Weeks before announcing the move in August 2019, Kashmir was turned into a fortress, with massive army deployment and the arrest of thousands of political leaders, activists, and academics. The muscular approach proved counterproductive as India lost the last vestiges of its goodwill in Kashmir.
The revocation of Kashmir's special status and attempts at altering the Muslim majority region's demography have come at a great cost for New Delhi. The BJP government's move appears to have alienated both Muslims and Hindus in Kashmir.
The government of India is saying that everything is normal here. Delegations, foreign delegations are coming here to visit, but they are not talking to anybody. Even media is not allowed to present their point of view. Only selected people are getting there and they are meeting them.
While it pushed Kashmiri Muslims further away, including those who swore by the Indian constitution before the events of August 2019, it also compounded the misery of minority groups in Kashmir. They feel more insecure today than at any point in history, despite the BJP government giving them greater representation in a recently released list of redrawn electoral constituencies in Kashmir. The muscular approach adopted by the Hindu nationalist government to suppress the majority Muslim community in the disputed region has proved to be a failed gambit. As per the official 2011 census of the region's total population of 12.5 million, Muslims comprise 68.31% and Hindus 28.43%. Even leaders of traditionally pro-India political outfits feel alienated today. Mehbooba Mufti, former chief minister of Kashmir, recently accused the Modi government of pushing young men towards armed resistance. She said the BJP builds its vote bank in the rest of India by suppressing Kashmiris. Even politicians in mainland India have slammed the move, questioning the wisdom behind it.
Now to talk more on this, we are joined by Dr. Sayed Nazir Gilani, President of Jammu and Kashmir Council for Human Rights from London, UK. Now, Dr. Gilani, welcome to the program. Now, 3 years after India's Hindu Nationalist Party, BJP, revoked Kashmir's semi-autonomous status, things appear to have gone from bad to worse. Now, do you think it was bound to happen?
Of course it was bound to happen, but it does not matter at all as far as the question of Kashmir is concerned, because it is Indian loss, not the loss of the people of Kashmir, because the temporary or the provisional accession that Kashmiris had with India, it was surrendered by the government of India at the UN on 15th of January 1948, so for a UN supervised vote. So until UN would have carried out a vote in Kashmir, the state of Jammu and Kashmir on the Indian side had a very temporary arrangement with the government of India how to conduct the business. So this was the link between Srinagar and Delhi, and they have broken it themselves. So it is a very difficult question, constitutional question, which Kashmiris have taken to the Supreme Court of India as well, but it is a violation of the UN template on Kashmir. It is a violation of Kashmiris' agreement with the New Delhi or Indian agreement with the government of Pakistan or the Indian assurance given to the British government in November 1948. So the Indian thought process that there might be in a position to curtail or to crush the popular resistance in Kashmir has not worked, because it is not something that India can very easily get away with. People have been through difficult times through centuries from 1846. So the connection with India has started in October 1947. So that does not mean that the people of Kashmir have given up on the question of rights, dignity, security, and self-determination. So India has to fail anyway, because its Indian failure and the connection between Kashmir and India does not exist at this point. The only connection is that we have a massive deployment of Indian army in the valley.
Dr. Gilani, the BJP government claimed the events of August 2019 would bring peace and prosperity to Kashmir, but we see the security situation has deteriorated and businesses have suffered huge losses. Now, can a muscular approach ever work in Kashmir's context?
One of the most senior Indian leaders, Yashwant Sinha, when he visited Kashmir and went back to Delhi before India decided to take the action on 5th of August 2019, he told the Indian public on national television that the only link between India and Kashmir are the coercive forces, our military deployment. A muscular approach has not worked around the world, and it won't work. It didn't work in Afghanistan, it didn't work in Iraq, it doesn't work in Palestine. It didn't work for Indians as well, for the British in India. So I don't think that those who harbor this this delusion that one day the Kashmiris might get exhausted or they might be without friends. We have a UN template on Kashmir. And for that, we have the assurance of 193 countries of the world. So the people of the state of Jammu and Kashmir are not the only people who live on the Indian side. There is another administration which is on the Pakistani side of Kashmir, and the third administration is Gilgit and Baltistan. So it would be very difficult for India to round up all these three administrations and then to put them under the military feet. It's very difficult. Indian civil society, the common man in India, is feeling guilty and remorseful that they have been very unkind, very deceitful, and very aggressive and inhumane in Kashmir. So we see in Kashmir a different India. The world knows India in one form, but we have known India in different form, where we have the orphans, we have the widows, we have the half widows, and we have the victims of Puran Pushpura gang rape and a whole list of human rights violations stand against the state of India. So it would be very difficult for them to live up in the form that they have decided to live on the Indian side of Kashmir, because they cannot overpower the people living on the Pakistani side of Kashmir, Gilgit, Baltistan, and 2.5 million Kashmiri Muslim refugees living in the four provinces of Pakistan, and a very huge, very aggressive, very refined and robust Kashmiri diaspora is there. So India has many fronts to stand up to. I don't think there will be that their spread is that broad that they will vanquish us on all fronts.
On that note, I would like to thank Dr. Gilani for his precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Kashmir-based journalist Akash Hassan shares a video of Indian police locking gates of a residential locality and stopping Kashmiri Hindu protesters who demand relocation following recent killings. Samar Halarankar, a New Delhi-based editor, quotes a Kashmiri Hindu saying that insecurity and killings of minorities rose after the revocation of Kashmir's special status by the Modi government. A Melbourne-based anti-Islamophobia activist, Sania Wajahat, asks why Indian Muslim activists who are speaking up now against the Modi government didn't break their silence when human rights violations were taking place in Kashmir.
And that was our episode about the growing ties between New Delhi and Moscow despite Western pressures and the Indian government's failed policy in Kashmir. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
In the limelight.
In Britain, the National Audit Office has made it clear that it is concerned at how the British government still maintains that it will build 40 entirely new hospitals, when in reality many will merely be extensions or refurbishments of existing ones. We now present you an article written by Toby Helm under the heading Boris Johnson Faces Investigation into Claims of Over 40 New Hospitals. The British government's official spending watchdog is to launch an inquiry into Prime Minister Boris Johnson's claim that 40 new hospitals will be built by 2030, as concerns grow in Whitehall that the pledge is unaffordable and has been greatly oversold to the public. In a move that could prove hugely embarrassing for the Prime Minister, the Independent National Audit Office, the NAO, has decided to conduct a value for money review into the entire scheme, which was a cornerstone of the Conservative Party's 2019 general election manifesto. The National Audit Office has made clear that it is concerned at how the government still maintains that it will build 40 entirely new hospitals, when in reality many will merely be extensions or refurbishments of existing ones. In a